Hello. You have found InnoTalks, the Innovation Studies podcast. My name is Roman Jurovetsky, and I'm an assistant professor in Innovation Studies and Data Science. As with many innovations, this podcast happened rather by accident. For the last 3 years, I spent most of April in China, where I coordinated and taught a module on innovation systems at a master program at the Sino-Danish Center and the University of the Chinese Academy of Science in Beijing. This year, due to the corona crisis, I stayed in Denmark. Most of my students are scattered around China and the rest of the world. It is a rather frustrating situation, and while online learning has its benefits, we all still need to find out how to make it interesting. I think right now in April 2020, we are already happy when we can upload video lectures and live sessions don't crash. To make online teaching a little bit more exciting for me and the students, I decided to bring some of the researchers from the discipline into the classroom. So I contacted many of my colleagues, but also other scholars that I know from reading their work and recorded interviews about their research. Luckily, most of them were happy to chat with me, and honestly, it was fun to discuss research with people across the globe without the oftentimes dense setting of a scientific conference or some workshop. These interviews proved to be more than just ivory tower chats about research papers, but more of a way to bring innovation studies findings into a current context and to debate some of the foundations. So all in all, this has been the feedback from my students so far. These interviews made researchers more approachable, which I think is something that we really need in our society today. Oftentimes in the dialogue, I would ask a question or link a thought to some other idea which triggered then potential new research ideas, and that was a lot of fun. The more I recorded, the more it became clear that these interviews would also be a great resource for a general public. I think we live in a busy world with ever-shortening attention spans, and finding times and being able to commit to reading a research article or an article at all is hard. At the same time, most of the research is written in a way that makes it difficult to access it. If it is possible at all, given all the paywalls by scientific journals. Also, we spend lots of time scrolling through social media feeds, maybe sometimes newspaper websites, and I'm totally guilty of doing that. For me, podcasts have been a very useful resource to keeping up with developments in different research areas, mainly computer science, but also to consume long-form content with complex ideas and complex argumentation that just doesn't fit into the format of Twitter. The innovation studies community has been shaping policy. It's been contributing to company strategies and many developments in the past decades. But only few of these researchers were able to communicate their ideas and findings to a broader audience. With this podcast, I would like to bring these findings and the context in which they have been formed into a format that I find makes most sense to understand complex and sometimes counterintuitive ideas and argumentation. So far, I have recorded chats with scholars working with innovation policy, sectoral development, sustainability transitions, and economic geography. What is common to the dialogues is the central role of learning, capacity building, recombination of ideas as a precondition for innovation to happen. You know, with smartphones, tablets, and online products coming out on a regular basis, we've gotten used to novelty and change, but I think that is important to understand what drives change and innovation. The first episode of this podcast will be an interview with Jochen Markart. Jochen is a senior researcher and lecturer at the Group for Sustainability and Technology, within the Department of Management, Technology and Economics of ETH Zurich in Switzerland. I would say Jochen is one of the central scholars within the sustainability transition community. The interview is recorded with co-host Daniel Hein, who is a friend and colleague, as well as a co-author of mine. In our chat with Jochen, we briefly addressed the various COVID-19 recovery programs currently put out by governments around the world, and especially what that means from an innovation and sustainability perspective. We talk about the core ideas of the sustainability transitions field and how and where these ideas can contribute today. And now, without further delay, I bring you the interview with Jochen Marquardt. With me on the line, Jochen Marquardt, and as co-host today, Daniel Hein. Hi, Daniel.
Hello again.
And hello, Jochen. Jochen, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? And where are you right now, actually?
Yeah, well, I'm. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you. I'm in Zurich right now. I work with the ETH, which is the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. And I'm working here in a department for management, technology, and economics. In our group, we have a lot of management scholars and other social and technical scientists working on sustainability issues very broadly, but also many on energy issues, some on circular economy, and usually in combination with looking at firms or looking what firms do in terms of sustainability. And my personal background and field of research is what we call sustainability transitions, which is, if you will, a macro perspective on how larger sectors, let's say energy or transport, how they change over time in a more fundamental way. For example, in energy, the ongoing transition from fossil and nuclear energy sources to renewables, and how these changes unfold and what they mean for innovation dynamics, what they mean for incumbent businesses, what they mean for consumers, these kinds of issues. This is what we are looking at.
I guess just as what happens right now here in Denmark and all around the world, Switzerland is probably on lockdown as well. Am I right?
Yes, we are on lockdown. And it's very sad and troubling times. And life for most of us has changed. I mean, as academics, we're still in a very comfortable position. I mean, we can work mostly from, we have to, but we also can work from home. And we are not at the forefront of, keeping this society running. And of course, I have a lot of respect for those who do, like those in hospitals or stores or, farming, food provision, energy provision, all the basic services we still depend on. And it's very, disruptive.
No, I think we are in a very, very comfortable situation, I'd say. Of course, it's sad to not see colleagues at conferences or, to interact more closer with people and students, but in a way, I think we are lucky in a situation where we are.
Yeah, but then there are also in all these troubling and sad times, then there are also like nice moments or moments of hope. For example, today I went to my favorite Asian takeaway, and of course, this is a small business and they have hardly any customers, but they were friendly as ever. They were, of course, lucky to see face in somebody wanting food, and then we exchanged April Fool's jokes, and it was a nice, it's also good to, we were keeping all the social distance and stuff, but it's also cool, nice to meet people and to see that some businesses are still running, and gives me hope that we will return to, let's say, somewhat more normal times, hopefully soon.
I mean, one thing that I keep seeing on social media and other places are articles coming out these days saying things like, after this crisis, is actually a chance. We will reconsider the way how we work. We will reconsider the way how we travel, how we teach, yeah, as well. So, I mean, as a sustainability scholar, what are you, aside from, you know, the conceptual frameworks and these things, but what are your thoughts on these kind of ideas coming out right now?
I'm concerned, but I'm mostly hopeful. On the other hand, I also see, it's clear we are confronted with a major shock, something that is pervasive, that affects every sector, that affects every country. And I mean, we don't know what happens. And so uncertainty is high and we don't know what comes after. But like personally, I'm hopeful. But then again, for example, I also see, now every state is setting up these economic recovery programs, for example. And then I just learned the other day that, for example, the Trump administration sought to use economic stimulus money to bail out fossil fuel industry players, right? Or just yesterday, the German Council of Economic Experts, they are advisors to the government. They issued a 110 pages assessment report and policy recommendations on the crisis. And in the entire report, sustainability or climate is not mentioned once. Right? So, I mean, of course, policy makers are doing things, but I'm a little concerned that they are not using the opportunity, or that they are even at risk channeling, you know, these recovery funds into businesses we want to discontinue in the long run, or that they, you know, just spread them everywhere without any sustainability considerations.
So you think that things like, you know, jobs and just keeping the economy running may wait more than long-term sustainability goals these days, unfortunately, or maybe there is something about lobbying.
Like in every political decision process, we have short-term and long-term objectives, and we have different interests at play. And of course, a lot of resources will be needed to keep the businesses running, but then still I would argue, and to Danny to get together with Danny Rosenblum, we're currently developing some thoughts around what we call leveraging, for example, that we use the dynamics and the resources that will be spent in the crisis to also address sustainability concerns, for example, climate concerns. I mean, in fact, we're confronted with at least two crises at the moment, the long-term crisis, which is climate, and the short-term crisis, which is corona. And it would be not ideal, to say moderately, to now spend much of the resources we have on just, let's say, regular economic recovery, like for every industry, without considering that we might support industries that in the mid to long term, we want to get rid of, for example, coal or other fossil fuels, you know, and then we might also want to think about how we can, with the already destabilizing effect of the crisis, can use some of these disruptive dynamics that are ongoing to say, okay, these dynamics are, for example, also affecting oil or tar sands or coal mining. And why don't we use the recovery money to really to support the phase out of these carbon intensive technologies and industries? You know, for example, retire people in these jobs, retrain them, compensate businesses for some of their assets, but not not with the intention to sustain these businesses, but with the intention to, you know, replace them by more innovative technologies, and then of course invest more and more strongly in renewables, in electric vehicles, in public transit, all these kinds of sustainable alternatives we already have.
I mean, I guess it's also a big question about, what are the people, the voices advocating these ideas? And I'm just thinking, like, whom should we be supporting, maybe? Like, what kind of actors? Because obviously it is a contested kind of field right now, with vested interests, obviously, in industrial players, in established industries. And maybe
and the likelihood, I mean, we saw it with the economic crisis back in 2008, 2009. I mean, the likelihood is always high that the incumbent industries have a strong voice at the table and that they are those who receive most of the economic recovery funds, which in some cases might very much make sense, for example, when it comes to farming. I mean, as an industry, but then again, we could, for example, even with farming, reconsider whether sustainable farming or organic farming and conventional farming, whether we should differentiate, I mean, whether we should use, I'm a bit hesitant to say this opportunity, but whether we should use the current situation to also rethink why, for example, I mean, how we allocate the funding and perhaps farmers who do organic farming receive more of the funding than those who don't, and so on. Yeah.
What will you say is our role as researchers right now in such a situation? Is it like the right time to raise our voices and just become a little bit more, you know, pronounced out there? Because, you know, of course, there is some kind of crisis, I guess, also on our side in the last couple of years. You know, we just produce articles and produce more and more articles, and the question is, you know, where is it all going?
Yeah, I mean, of course we have to raise our voice, and of course we have to continue publishing. That's our job, that's what we do, doing studies and doing thorough analysis of, you know, of the dynamics we're observing. But yes, we are also, in a sense, advocates of, or we can become advocates of, I mean, especially when it comes to sustainability and climate change. I mean, these issues of fundamental importance for society and humanity, or the Earth as a whole, if you will, even, that we repeatedly have to raise our voices to emphasize, well, it's important to not just follow the, you know, or and continue along the existing pathways and not just repeat, for example, the mistakes we did in the past, but that we deviate, or that we use the current crisis also to, you know, rethink of what we're doing. And yes, we should have a strong voice in this. And especially, I mean, of course, I'm doing a bit of self-marketing here, but transition studies has some answers of how to reorient entire sectors and societies towards more sustainable modes of production.
And I think, yeah, that provides a very good segue into what we wanted to talk about here today, and it is transition studies, but also, you know, the conceptual frameworks around that. And I'm just thinking, you know, it's always what you already said, it's always this kind of tension between the existing and the pathways that we're in and the potential new stuff and the new solutions, new processes coming in. So would you say this is the fundamental dilemma of these kind of transitions?
Yeah, you can call it a dilemma. I would also call it, this is like a normal struggle of interests. You have incumbent interests that, incumbent industries like the traditional car makers, for example, in countries like Germany, or, I don't know, coal mining in Australia, oil supply in Norway. I mean, these are traditionally strong industries with vested interests and with a high influence, typically, on policy, be it through direct ties, be it through their role in the economy, be it through the jobs they create, be it through, the taxes they pay, and so on, right? And I mean, these industries, of course, try to do everything to stay in business and stay with their existing businesses. And for them, it has been traditionally very difficult. I mean, traditionally very difficult to change their business models and really to embrace radically new technologies. I mean, the automakers have waited very, very long time to really invest heavily in electric vehicles, for example. Or, you know, other industries, in other industries, we see similar patterns. The electricity industry in many countries, or the electricity suppliers in many countries, they have fought against renewables for many years. Today, they regard renewables as part of their core business. But they, I mean, several years back, they were fighting intensely against these alternatives because they were perceived as a threat. And it was a recurring, you know, view on things to say, these renewables, they will never take off. They will always be too expensive. This is not working. We will always need nuclear. We will always need coal. And today we are in a situation where nuclear and coal are much more expensive than many of the alternative renewables like wind and solar. So it's these tech dynamics. And this is what, of course, one of the key lessons from transition studies, these technology developments and the underlying dynamics can be so fundamental and so the dynamics in these new technologies, they often exceed the expectations of many of those involved, and they can be much faster or progress can go much further than people would have expected. For example, we just did a study on the phase out of the coal industry in the UK. And you might know that the UK is a country that was always heavily relying on coal as a primary source of energy. They had coal mining and they also used coal for heating and also for electricity production. And during the last 5 years, they have seen an incredible decline in the use of coal for power generation. So just within a few years, the share of coal in the power system fell from around 40% to to a few percent. And in a few years, coal will be phased out entirely. And such strong dynamics are usually way beyond, way faster than experts have forecasted in the past. And this is also, I mean, that's the point I'm getting at. There might be dynamics at play that are very strong and that might be underestimated in the first place. And this also gives us hope. So we can always have hope when looking at these sustainable developments that some of the technology dynamics kick in very fast as soon as there are sufficient resources channeled into these, for example, new technologies or new infrastructures.
But don't we have a bit of a contradiction there? Before, we were talking about targeted investments, not broad overall investments by the government, not necessarily, for example, pouring money into coal, but more targeted into renewable energy. But now we figured out, and that's one of the general arguments against technology policy and industry policy, that actually the government is said to be very bad in picking winners, in choosing what's going to be the technology we should invest in the future, what is going to be the industry we should invest in, either because they don't have the foresight to start with, they're not dynamic enough, they're probably also influenced by vested interests and lobbying and so on and so forth. So what is the role of a government in such a system where you have unforeseeable and sometimes very dynamic and radical and fast technological change?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. So as a basic principle, technology development is always associated with very high uncertainties. So nobody knows. Not the businesses, nor research, nor policymakers. Nobody knows nobody knows which will be the technologies of the future. Many of us have expectations, have potentially even visions of the future, whether this might be a fully renewable future, whether we might have autonomous electric vehicles on the roads, whether we might even have flying vehicles, or maybe very little individual transport in the first place. Maybe everything, like, for example, in Zurich, where I'm living, I mean, public transit is the major backbone of not just the city, but the entire country. That is something that is hard to imagine in other places, for example, like North America. So what I'm saying is we don't know what the future will be. We don't know how it will look like and which technologies will succeed. So as a general strategy, it's advisable to pursue different technologies, to pursue different bets, if you will, and to see which one works out and which, and you know, someone might be a success and others might fail. And that's a normal dynamic of the game, if you will. But of course, the role of government is twofold. At some point, maintaining a strong flow of innovation and channeling money into innovation without necessarily picking winners, but also the government needs to set direction, and this is usually based on broad societal processes of participation, to say which are the major transformations we want to do. And for example, in Germany, there was a long-standing debate on the future of nuclear. And at some point, society said, and then the government also said, we do not want to work with this technology in the future. And that's a clear decision. And in a similar way, the UK government or the German government later said, we are confronted with climate change and we do one step, for example, by banning fossil fuel in the sense of coal-fired power generation. And that's also a decision a country or a state can and should do, to say, hey, in the long run, these industries will be phased out. And then this is also a clear sign for, okay, now there is room for alternatives. In the UK, for example, they have ramped up renewables. That's part of the substitution of coal, but they have also still a lot of electricity from natural gas, which is still fossil. So, of course, then the next step will be, okay, what comes after the phase out of coal? How do we deal with natural gas? How can it be substituted? Should there be more investments into energy efficiency? And there are no, you know, as I said before, there are no straightforward answers, but there are pros and cons, but it's important for the state to set the general direction and to also set some guidelines, saying, okay, these industries we don't want in the long run. That's something that's also something that's advisable in my experience.
I'd like to get a little bit more nerdy on that. And with nerdy, I mean... and with nerdy, I mean just going a little bit deeper into the research and the frameworks that are around. And for me, as I would consider myself a person that's a little bit like on the periphery of this field. I mean, during my PhD, I worked with energy, but I never got really into the sustainability research. And for me as an outsider, I'd say, or a periphery person, I see there is these kind of two camps when looking at this area of research and this tradition. So there is, people on the innovation system side with a technological innovation systems framework being there since the mid-2000s, I would say. And then there is this multi-level perspective kind of STS, science, technology, studies, informed perspective. So, and I know that you have been working initially in trying to kind of bring the two together. At least this is the impression I get from looking at the publication. So where are we right now in this area, and how does the field look from your perspective right now? Where also the main challenges may be from a researcher perspective?
Yeah, let's get dirty. Let's talk about the field of sustainability transitions and the frameworks therein. And it is correct that innovation systems approaches, but also what we call the multi-level perspective, which is a framework that, which is, if you will, the core transitions framework. So the multi-level perspective explains how socio-technical systems, such as those in energy, transform from, let's say, fossil fuel-based power production to renewables power production, with technologies in niches, emerging and maturing over time, while incumbent technologies getting under pressure and declining, and then there is a continuous or more disruptive substitution process. And these kinds of transitions, they take a long time, typically a couple of decades or even 50 years or so. And so the multi-level perspective is the core framework to explain these kind of dynamics. The innovation systems perspective, and especially the TIS perspective, typically focuses on a selected technology. Say wind power or solar or electric vehicles or carbon capture storage technology. I mean, whatever technology you can think of, it usually focuses on a specific technology and then looks at who are the actors supporting this technology, what are the policies supporting these technologies. And especially, or a specialty of the TIS perspective, is to look at key processes. They are also called functions. They look at, for example, market formation or knowledge generation or legitimation. There are different kinds of what they call core processes that are needed to run smoothly and be in place in order for an innovation to develop and mature. If you will, on the one hand, we have an innovation perspective, which is more looking at the emerging, or used to look more at the emerging things. And on the other hand, you have a transformation perspective with a multi-level perspective, which looks at the changes in entire sectors. And like personally, I would say, I guess the MLP has its strengths. It's very intuitive in its appeal. So this is... For newcomers to the field, they look at the concepts and they say, oh, there is a regime, this is the stable, this is where the incumbents are, there are niches that are competing, there is a lot of struggle and tensions between the regime and the niche players, and then there are these landscape level developments, which like, for example, the corona crisis we talked about before. This is a classic landscape shock. So there is something, a major event happening, disrupting the regime, and that might be the time for, you know, niches to break through. So this is a very strong appeal, that the multi-level perspective is very intuitive. It emphasizes the struggle between niche and regime, and it's conceptually sound based, for example, in a lot of social science theories. What combines the two, and or what is a commonality of the two, is clearly that they are both based on a systems understanding of dynamics, and they are both what we call multidimensional. So what does it mean? That means we are not just looking, we might be very much interested in, but we are not just looking at technologies, but we are also looking at the non-technical dynamics going on. So we look at actors, at business models, at institutions, at policies, at infrastructures, at user practices, at social movements. You know, there's a lot of things going on when we talk about social technical change. And we look at these things when we talk in transition studies, we look at these things from a systemic perspective. That means all of these different elements are interacting, and we cannot just focus on one and forgetting about the others. And yeah, that's basically the point. And coming back to the strengths, so the multi-level perspective has clear strengths, but also the technological innovation systems perspective has clear strengths. For example, this focus on actors, this focus on functions or processes for the system to perform well. And it's also, you know, kind of easy for scholars to apply and to think in terms of these different functions.
I mean, I would like to get back to what we were discussing before, and that was this question of picking winners. And I'm just thinking, in a framework like the technological innovation system, where basically in one of the early steps when you run such an analysis, you're basically have to delineate the system to say, okay, these are the actors and this is the technology that I'm looking at. I mean, aren't you automatically funneled into a situation where you're picking winners?
That's a good point. It seems like, and we also had a special issue a while back on this debate. It seems like that the TIS perspective has an underlying normative component, saying if I study, for example, the technology dynamics of wind power, then I want wind power to succeed. But this is not the decision of the researcher to make. So as researchers, we take novel technologies and we study them. And then why this normative where this normative perspective comes in is that usually then many researchers in TIS studies conclude their study saying, okay, here are my policy recommendations. So if you want to strengthen the innovation in wind power, then you need to do A, B, and C, right? And that seems like a strategy of picking winners. But the conclusions are typically formulated with, if you want to do this, then you should follow the following, or here are our recommendations. But this is not the decision of the researcher, but this if is usually the decision of policymakers and of the outcome of political processes. This is where societies decide, yes, we want to invest more strongly in alternative technologies. And then I can come with Germany, but also with Denmark. Then policymakers in these countries, they say, okay, let's explore technology X, or let's invest into technology Y. And for example, Denmark was very early to say, let's invest or let's see and support wind power and biogas or biomass use. And so did other countries. And these decisions are not for us researchers to make which technology to choose, but we do the analysis. If policymakers want to support one of these technologies, then we say, hey, we have a set of tools and analyses available that help you to achieve this goal.
I would like to very briefly get away a little bit from sustainability and just take a different example. One of our PhD students is right now looking at digitalization and education and how these digital technologies, basically how EdTech evolves. And as it so happens, we have the Corona crisis situation and everyone suddenly needs to teach online. What a wonderful case for his PhD. But I'm just thinking, when I look right now at many colleagues and, in different places, it feels a little bit like, there was always this idea at different levels of the education system. Oh, yes, we need this. This is the future. We need to do digital teaching. We need to become better. And at the same time, there is just such a resistance to doing these things, even though I don't feel like there is a lot of vested interests in terms of, you know, heavy infrastructure or kind of under investments. It just seems to me like a routine thing that people are kind of unwilling to accept, that suddenly their role as professors or educators changes and they become a podcaster or a YouTuber or something.
Yeah, I can only share your impression. And part of the resistance, and also part of the regime, if you will. So the regime is typically the element in the MLP that does not want to change. And part of the resistance in the regime comes from every one of us, comes from what are we used to? What do we typically do on a daily basis? How do we typically, or how are we used to teaching? Or how are we used to, I don't know, what lives are we typically leading? And any major change in these routines creates resistance. Of course, and this is in a sense pretty easy as an explanation, but it's pretty difficult to change if it's an obstacle to innovation. We have this, for example, in mobility. Mobility is a complex topic. And of course, as I said before, when you have, for example, North America, there are places where, you know, the urban structure is organized in a way that people live very far away from their workplaces, and there is no public transit, and there is no decent bike lanes or, you know, multimodal kind of transport services. So the only chance they have is driving a car. But then people also get used to driving a car. So the car is the general answer for every mobility challenge you have. So that also means you go to other places where you might not rely on the car, but still it's in your head like, okay, I want to go from place A to B, then I need a car to do this, right? And that's the tricky thing, that there are these many factors that are playing into how we deal with technology and how we organize our lives. And yes, over time, we develop routines and habits and, yes, lifestyles and ways of how we organize our lives. And then once we have organize them in this way, it's very difficult to change. And we don't want this because this is what we're used to. And then again, this is also an opportunity, the corona crisis, or let's not necessarily an opportunity, but this is at least an example of a major disruption of lifestyles that, for example, we are now forced not to commute, to stay at home, to not go on holidays, to break with many of the daily routines, and potentially and hopefully, but potentially we are maybe also reflecting on some of these, and we are already changing them. It's unclear whether some of these changes will prevail and become more permanent, or whether we will flip back into the old styles, like as soon as the crisis is over, we don't know. But, you know, at least at the moment, we have a bit of a chance on reflecting about what we do and whether it's, strictly speaking, necessary to do it or to live our lives the way we do. But this is already now getting almost
philosophical. No, it goes a little bit further. I have a few more questions, but one thing that I'm just thinking about right now as you say these things is, if I think about the equivalent to many of the things that you just mentioned, and think about the equivalent in innovation management more on the company side of things, and it feels like it's kind of the same thing, right? So you try to, you know, innovate in your organization, I mean, that's certainly not the societal level, but more an organizational level. And, you know, there we came up with many interesting techniques and frameworks and tools on the management side to push innovations, you know, to, you know, stimulate ideation and, you know, to let people kind of adopt new ways, because this is part of what organizations do when they innovate.
Mm-hmm.
So shouldn't there be also a little bit more discussion between, you know, between people looking at transitions in a more societal context and, on the other hand, the management community? Or is the, does it actually exist, this discussion?
So I give you an example from what we do. So we have, this is within our group, we have, for example, some of our researchers who are working very closely together with firms to help them solve sustainability problems. And this is hands-on. They use their insights they have from their research backgrounds, and of course they are also working within or seeing the, you know, practical constraints and like who is in charge in the firm, what kind of changes are possible and what do they want and what do they not want. And they, if you will, work somewhat in the trenches of existing businesses, trying to make them more sustainable. And then we have also, for example, students who do studies, like typically master students who do studies on specific firms or their business models or corporate sustainability issues, these kinds of things. And just lately, we had a student who was looking into the carbon emissions of concrete. So the student was working with a major Swiss concrete manufacturer, and they were, I mean, the task was to find out what are potentials for deep decarbonization of concrete. And of course there are a couple of suggestions, like you can use biofuels in the concrete making process, or you can maybe further down the road use carbon capture and storage technologies in concrete manufacturing. And all these technological solutions come with different price tags, and biofuels is cheaper, and CCS, carbon capture storage, is more expensive, and then you can have discussions around these. So far, so normal, right? But then we also came into what alternatives do we have? Because concrete as such is a highly intense, carbon-intense product, and it's very difficult to really fully decarbonize concrete. And if we are talking about a deep decarbonization of society in, let's say, 2050, we really have to think beyond the existing, maybe also materials. And then we came into a discussion, what are the alternatives to concrete, by the way? And then, of course, the reaction from the firm was, well, I mean, we are a concrete firm. How can we, you know, we are not in construction, we are in concrete manufacturing. So how... It doesn't make sense for us to think about alternatives to concrete, because concrete is what we do, right? This is our very existence. But then again, in a more fundamental perspective on transitions, you might find answers saying, well, you might have been in the concrete business, but maybe you have to really radically rethink your business model and saying, well, we can also redefine what we do as delivering construction materials. And then we can think for, you know, more flexibly of what is the best construction material for the purpose at hand. And then it might be concrete, but it might also be wood, or it might be other materials for different kinds of buildings or different kinds of purposes.
Yeah. And this is a thing, yeah, this is a great example of, you know, how you can think in business model innovation into this process, and that there is also clearly a need to interact with people working with these kind of things.
And this is very radical for firms. This is not the usual way of thinking, because the usual way is like, I have my business, I need to make profit, I'm working on a tight margin, and I only have a very limited choice of options, right? And this is all that I can do. But if you think more long term, if you do not think about the next year, but let's say about 10 or 20 years down the road, then you might also be able to, you know, open up the scope of options that might be available to you. Or not.
Clearly, yeah.
I mean, there's always an option. You know, this is also, in a sense, a bit what we're seeing in the automotive industry. So I would argue that most of the, let's say, traditional or incumbent automakers were not really eager to push alternative vehicle technologies. I mean, they always had their innovation going on. They did electric mobility almost 10, 15 years back. They did fuel cells many years back. They were working with different sizes of cars, but in the end, they sticked to the internal combustion engine. They built even bigger cars with the SUVs. So they remained fully within the mainstream of their business and technology. So very little change, fully regime compatible. And it needed an outsider such as Tesla before it was Toyota with the hybrid car. So it needed challengers. Toyota was an insider, but Tesla was an outsider. It needed challengers to really disrupt the automotive industry. And today, almost all auto manufacturers are working with electric cars. Yeah, and so these things, I mean, it shows you how strong the resistance can be. But then if somebody pushes them, it can also go very fast in the thing that they are changing there.
No, that's quite fascinating what you're saying there. And I think, I mean, one of your recent papers deals with the decline of technology. And I almost read it a little bit like euthanizing some of the technologies that we have to make space for new solutions to come. Could you briefly say something about that? Am I understanding the paper right?
Can you help me? Which paper are you talking about exactly?
I'm talking about the technological innovation system life cycles paper and the decline of technologies.
Yes, of course. In this paper, so as I said earlier, the technological innovation systems framework has usually been used to study emerging technologies. It was not developed for this purpose, but this is how we typically used it in transition studies. However, it can also be used to study more mature industries. And in this life cycle paper, we have tried to push the boundary even further, arguing, well, technologies see emergence, they see maturation, and they also see decline over sometimes years, sometimes decades. So over time, technologies change, and this has been done in other literatures before. You can assign a life cycle to technologies. And we were thinking, well, if this general idea of a life cycle is applicable to technologies, shouldn't it also be applicable to a TIS? So why did we want to do this? The intention is that we already had the TIS functions and the core processes to study in order to make or to support the system, for example, by policies, in a way to function better. So we already had these kinds of this kind of perspective that the TIS concept can be used to inform policymaking. And then we were like, okay, maybe the TIS framework can inform policymaking not only for emerging technology issues, but also for decline issues. And of course, in transitions, we always have both. New things emerge and existing things make room and decline. And this is why we were thinking, okay, we can use the TIS perspective also to study what happens when technologies decline over time. And then some of the original processes are reversed. For example, actors are leaving the TIS, legitimation goes down instead of up, markets decline instead of increase. Some of the processes are turning negative, but other processes are also new. And this is something we tried to develop in this paper. And meanwhile, we have used it to, for example, study nuclear, a technology that is interesting from a climate perspective, because some see it as a potential solution, because it's a low carbon energy generation technology. But then again, it's also technology that is associated with many risks, and it is also a technology that is very expensive. And by taking this life cycle perspective, we then looked, for example, at nuclear, and finding that, okay, nuclear is an exceptional case, but also we see many interesting dynamics at play where actor networks break up and get more loose over time, where costs go up instead of down over time, where legitimation decreases as more and more states are saying, no, we do not want to invest in the future of nuclear. You know, and then we try to analyze the current dynamics of nuclear from this TIS perspective, and we concluded in the end that there are many signs we see that nuclear is a technology that is in fact globally in a state of decline. Whether that means that we will be rid of nuclear anytime soon, probably not. There are still some states investing in nuclear. But, I mean, still many firms and many businesses are pulling out of it. It's getting more and more expensive. And so this is one way of how you can use the TIS perspective to analyze a current technology and also assess its potential with regard to is nuclear a solution for the climate crisis we are facing? And then our answer would be, nah, probably not. I mean, as I said before, you can never be sure. There can always be something happening. But at the moment, the chances look dim that nuclear, especially given how much time it takes and how much resistance there is in many places, we didn't see very high chances of nuclear really becoming a substantial solution to the climate crisis.
The question I would have here is, what I saw all the time now, or what I saw at least in my mind while you were talking, I was wondering, you made the case that nuclear might be on a declining trajectory, which I at least as not an expert, but somewhat an enthusiast in the topic agree. But the question then is, to what extent do you need active management in retirement, in a kind of an active policy orchestrated way, where we're coming back again to the role of policy? Is there a role, or should we just let it happen as it's going to happen anyhow? Because at one point, eventually, if the technological trajectory is exhausted, the industry would pivot on its own. Like here in this case, at the point when renewable energy is becoming so advanced and so cheap, and maybe also so scalable, that the price of energy will be less, then it's not up to any policy, then it's just an economic mechanism that kicks in and that will make a transformation on its own. Shouldn't we just wait for that?
I think in many fields of technological change, speaking more broadly, we can wait for one technology to for one technology to replace the other. For example, in consumer electronics, we can wait for I don't know the next iPhone to replace sooner or later all the former generations of iPhones. That's something I personally would not see no need to involve the state. With nuclear, nuclear in the first place, nuclear is a very specific technology. It has never, it was always applied with heavy state involvement, be it in research and innovation, be it in regulation and licensing, be it in strong financial support. Nuclear was strongly pushed by states. And of course, nuclear is also associated with nuclear weapons. And this is also where, this is clear, then the military comes in, and this is also then always national interests, these kinds of things. And so with nuclear, it's difficult to think of nuclear policy without the state. So, and we also see those states who are still pushing nuclear very strongly, namely China and Russia. You can also argue, yes, these are places where states and the role of the state traditionally plays a strong role. Do we need the state to push nuclear decline? Well, if you live in a country like Germany and you have a heated political debate around it, that settles it. If people don't want it, and if people elect politicians to support their interests, and if you have then a political decision to phase out nuclear, that's a political process you have to accept. If you look at the U.S., for example, you don't have such policy. So at the state level, some states are still in favor of nuclear, others are a little more hesitant, but there is no overarching policy to still invest or phase out nuclear. Nonetheless, the pattern there is all new, or most of the new investments into nuclear have halted or are significantly slowed down because it's just not paying off anymore. So here we see kind of the, if you will, normal innovation dynamics kicking in, because alternatives, which in the US is cheap natural gas from fracking, among others, and of course also renewables from wind and solar, are much, much cheaper than nuclear. So why invest in nuclear? If you look at coal, on the other hand, that's a different story, because coal is a technology that is significantly contributing to climate change. And the longer we run existing coal-fired power plants, the more CO2 we emit into the atmosphere, and the more costly it will be later to extract CO2 or to decarbonize more deeply. So for coal, I would argue it's less of an option to wait and see until all the old coal-fired power plants have been phased out and have become economically unfeasible. But there, it's important, in order to preserve or to at least try to mitigate climate change, there it's important that the state acts and accelerates the process of decline, that the state does not wait and see until the last coal-fired power plant is shut down, but that the state takes an active role to protect its citizens and to protect also our natural environment from these future emissions. And then I would say, yes, the state should step in and support an active and accelerated phase out of such industries, even before, for example, the economic lifetime of technologies or of specific power plants has been reached.
I'd like to ask a question, bringing the discussion a little bit back into the nerdy realm. Mm-hmm. And even though I appreciate a lot your ability, you know, to link it always obviously to the ongoing societal and political challenges that we are facing, but just thinking about the research community and transition studies or the whole field, where do you see it maybe in 2 years and 5 years? On the one hand, in terms of, you know, the frameworks that we have, the things that we discuss in this area, but also in relation to other adjacent fields, such as, you know, more traditional innovation research and maybe even innovation management. And you already mentioned business model research and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are at least two developments going on in the field. So one of the development is that we're continuously, or at least some of us are trying to continuously improve the existing frameworks in order to, so that they are better able to deal with the more and more complex phenomena we are looking at. For example, as we talked about before, looking not just at emergence of technologies, but also at decline, that's something where we have developed existing frameworks further in order to also address these things as they are ongoing. We have these real-world transitions happening out there, so of course then we want always to have the most up-to-date frameworks in order to deal with these phenomena. The other development we see is, and for that you have to keep in mind, transition studies is a very new field, so we have only existed for, let's say, 10, maybe 15 years. We're at the moment about, let's say, 2,000 researchers, maybe a little more. We're quite productive, but we are still a small fish in a big ocean. So we are far smaller than many of the established disciplines. This includes innovation studies more broadly, and even bigger fields like, let's say, management studies or political sciences. These are traditional disciplines, and we are not. And obviously, one of the strategies for research in sustainability transition is to link with dominant discourses in these other fields. To say, okay, what are key concepts? For example, in management studies, scholars are using corporate sustainability or looking into innovation ecosystems. So there are other concepts or approaches to deal with similar questions. And then always the question arises, so what is the benefit of approaching the same phenomena, let's say, from a management studies background using their frameworks, or from a sustainability transitions background and using, for example, technological innovation systems or the multi-level perspective? And, well, it usually... There are pros and cons, and it tends to be a question of where do you want to publish your paper, which audience are you talking to, but there's also a lot of potential to learn from other communities and other scholars by looking at things from a different perspective. For example, in transition studies, for many years, scholars have not really paid a lot of attention to firms and strategy making at the firm level. That was something many of our researchers were not super interested in. And now that that these transitions are taking off, that we see many firms really investing into these new technologies, we see that these processes, as recumbents also reorient themselves, we see that these processes, also the management decisions made in these firms, become more relevant. And then there is also a stronger inclination to look into how management scholars typically approach these issues. And similarly, there are similar parallels to the field of political sciences. Policy and policy making has usually been a bit, or the policy process has usually been a bit black boxed by transition policymakers, sustainability transition researchers. But in recent years, more and more in our field, supported by political scientists, by training, have, you know, opened up our frameworks and have incorporated political processes. And for example, when we today talk about mobility transition policy, we are, among others, talking about sequences of policy making that include a variety of policies that are adapted over time, policy learning in accordance to technology development, and stepwise policy making. So in order to, for example, mobilize supportive coalitions around these transformative changes, and in order to mitigate the resistance by incumbent actors, for example, against these changes. And so I would argue, at least we have tried to work towards, you know, opening up the field and our concepts to, you know, the knowledge and the concepts that were or are already available in other fields, and trying to work on the intersections of the different fields. And that has been, at least in my experience, a pretty, yeah, successful and fruitful development so far.
Yeah. And I guess things such as this podcast, for example, could contribute to some of these dialogues and shaping these connections. Well, of course, it's been a fascinating.
We have to discuss these things. We always have to question ourselves. I'm always arguing we should be the strongest critiques of ourselves. So instead of criticizing the frameworks others work with, we should at first criticize the frameworks we ourselves work with, because these are the frameworks we know best, and we know best the limitations of these frameworks. So we should remain critical always about what we're doing and how we can improve it.
Well, it has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much, Johan, for joining this chat.
Thank you.
It's been really, really nice. So, that was it for today. And
thanks a lot, and good luck with transition studies, wherever it might lead you.
All right. Bye.
Hey, thank you. Bye.
Goodbye.
And this was the show for today. I hope you learned something, and if you like this podcast, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to your podcast. You can also leave us a voice message if you like on the Anchor page of this podcast. And so far, we don't have a social media presence, but I will let you know as soon as I found time to set up all of these things. So, that's it for today, and I see you next time.